Interview is being conducted on the memoirs of Herb Conway at his residence, 1129 Logan, Corpus Christi, Texas, on his 19th day of December, 1972. The interviewer is Albert Fitzgerald. Mr. Conway, would you mention how you when and how you came to Texas?
Yes, my daddy and mother came to Texas in 1906, and we landed in a little town on the Katy Railroad, a little town called Bruceville, Texas. And my daddy's brother was there with a wagon, and we all got in the wagon and drove about 7 miles out to where he had leased a farm for my daddy. And when we got there, he had the furniture, everything in the house. We had, he and his wife had set it up that we just move right in with our clothing that we brought along with us. And I remember that evening that I was out playing, looking at the new country over, and I was scratching around where they had been burning some wood stuff in the backyard, and I picked up a silver dime out of the ashes, and I still have that dime somewhere in my keepsake now. So Daddy started farming, and that was 1907, 1908, and 1909. And the man that owned the farm came over in 1909, and I was listening to him. His name was Mr. Fizer. And he and my daddy were talking about buying land. He wanted my daddy to buy the land that he had leased from him. He was paying money lease, so much an acre, and he wanted Daddy to buy this farm. And Daddy wanted to buy it, and Mother's afraid we couldn't pay for it, and so they decided against buying it, and we could have bought it then for $9 from a half an acre. I remember the price that was quoted, $9 and a half an acre. That's 1909. And it was good farmland. It was bottomland. And that same land that Daddy could have bought in 1909 for $9.50 an acre sold in 1918 for $275 an acre, just 9 years later. It sold for $275 an acre. And why I remember it was Daddy and Mother were talking about, you know, what they missed by not buying this land. And one of Daddy's friends, by the name of Tom Dillard, had a dry goods store in Mooresville, Texas, bought the land. And I was talking to a fella from up there just a week ago, and he said that land was bringing $500 an acre now. That's how much the changes in value of land is in. And they don't even farm it anymore. They've got it turned into, they've planted in grass and they're running cattle on it. They don't farm it. They couldn't pay for it with my farming. It wouldn't pay itself out. So they're putting it all back into ranch country. It's just open ranch country, not many timber to speak of, but it's grown up in different grasses, buffalo and different bluegrass, stuff like that, and they're making money on it. But I've often thought if we'd had bought this land, well, even if, you know, if you just paid for a little of it, it would really have been something, but we didn't do it. But Daddy bought some land, and he bought some land in 1920, I guess that my baby brother, he still owns it. When daddy and mother died, well, we'll hem the place because he kept the daddy and mother after he got it in years. But he didn't buy it for $9.50 an acre like he could have bought it one time. But most of your crops back in what we settled was cotton and corn and red top sorghum. And then later years when it began to get more land in cultivation, they raised oats, millet. But oats was a big grain crop. But your main crop for your money was cotton. If you didn't make a good cotton crop, you didn't have any money. And a lot of people had missed out on it too, but that was your main crop for money, was cotton crop. And they had the ranches in different parts of the country, but none in the central part. But it's all gone back into ranch country. No more farming. All the country I was raised in is back in ranch country now.
What, you remember the droughts of 1914,
1918? The drought that I set in, we had a drought that began in the central part of the state. It started in 1914. Why I remember so well, that was the year that most of the boys left for the war in World War I of 1914. And we didn't make much crop, didn't anybody make much crop because it was so dry. In 1915 they didn't make any, it continued. We had a little rain, but we never did get any a good big rains. And in 1916, and we had one big rain in April in 1916. It flooded the rivers, but that was the only big rain that we had. 1917 was a dry year. 1916 and 17 and 18, and then 19 and 19 we had a wet year. We had lots of rain. And cotton went to 40, up as high as 42.3 cents a pound. But people didn't make much cotton. It didn't do too much good for them, and because they didn't have the cotton, they couldn't. The insects eat it up. It rained so much. Cattle got cheap. In 1920 and 21, I helped my daddy turn cattle out on the road and run them off, good registered cows, to get them off the pasture. You couldn't sell a mule, you couldn't sell a cow, or anything like that. But then in 1922 and 23, crops come in pretty good, and 24 come in pretty good. And people bought some new cars in 24, and then 25, another draft hit them. They didn't make anything, but they managed to survive. Most of them part of them had to sell with the automobiles to pay for them, but most of them got to keep them. And then in 1926 and 27, it began to get better, but never did get too good. It got awfully bad as during the it was a Republican, I believe, was in office, but I believe Roosevelt went in 1930. I believe that's the year he went to office, and he created jobs for everybody. He gave every man that wanted to work something to do. And things began to pick up. He bought people's hogs, and he bought the bees. Then he burned the bees and killed the hogs and bought the cotton crop and had them plowed up in the field. They couldn't harvest it. They had to destroy it, plowed up the field. But he'd taken the stuff off the market, and then cotton began to grow up, and everybody began to get money again, a little bit to spend. And it just kept getting a little better and a little better, and up until the World War II come along. Of course, everybody had jobs in the World War II, and everybody had money. It was quite different to what World War I was. Nobody had the money in World War I, but everybody had money in World War II because they had a lot more jobs. Our president, some way or other, had more jobs available, and there was just more money in circulation.
What do you remember about early politics in Texas?
Well, back in the 1900s, your main politics was sheriff office and the county judge and the governor. And when you, those three was about the, that was the main ones. And they were the ones that were talked about the most, and they were real interested in who was going to be sheriff or who was going to be county judge, who was going to be governor. I think they were more interested in the sheriff's race than there was anything back in the early 1900s on up to, well, on up to 1936. 1934 and 36, we had a hot race for sheriff. That sheriff's race was the main race, and everything else could be forgotten about, but everybody knew who was running for sheriff and who they wanted. And we had some good sheriffs, too. We've had some good sheriffs here. We've had John Harney was one of our heroes here in Nueces County. Bill Shealy, and then we had Sheriff Bill Anderson, B County, and he was a real hero. He had quite a job, but he cleaned up the country, that is the town. B cleaned up the B County, and he put it back on the map, and he's still remembered, and a lot of people wish they had him back for sheriff today.
Could you explain how he cleaned up B County?
Yeah, when he went in the sheriff's office, he stayed on the job. He was in town all of his spare time. He was there, and if somebody did something wrong, he didn't hesitate to tell him what he was doing. And if he told him to do something, and he didn't do it, he had Bale to fight, or he had mine. And Bale never did lose any fights that I knew anything about. All them I ever knew he had, he always won. But I don't think he ever did anything that he should have done. He had a reason to do the jobs he did. He went out one afternoon to the hats. Bunch of Latin Americans, whatever you want to call them, Mexicans had gotten there. They were having a big fight, and they went out there, and there was some of them under the house.
You remember who they were?
Oh, yeah. They had this Mexican feud going on out at the, on the, in the country. And they went out there to get to stop the trouble. And they had one or two of the Mexicans had hid under the house and some on the outside. And anyhow, one of them shot at Bale. And Bale had a Thompson submachine gun with him in the car. So he got that thing out of the car, and I believe he wound up with, he killed either six or nine out there before he got that thing stopped, but he put a stop to it. And he shot one or two of them under the house, or some out from the house that was hit, but he won out. He came out without getting hurt. And then there was two boys that robbed the post office at Pettus one morning. No, they were, yeah, it was out at Pettus there, close to Pettus. And they called Bale, and Bale got in his car, and he overtaken them somewhere on the, out in a little filling station out at Pettus. They were filling the car up with gas. And he arrested them and took them both inside, and he made them clean against the wall, and he searched them to see that they didn't have any weapons on them. But one of them had a 38 Smith & Wesson break open up in the top of his, on top of his head, on his hat, in the clamp. And when Bale turned his back, well, he reached up there and got this gun out from under his hat, and he shot Bale five times through the stomach. This gun was just a five-shot gun, is all it was. It wasn't the little break over this 38 S. But when Bale fell, he pulled his own 44. He wore 44 Smith & Wesson all the time. That was his favorite gun. He pulled it, and he shot both of them dead before he fell. He shot one of them all in the chest, and he shot the other right at the forehead there when he, before he passed out. And they got him to the hospital, and they thought he was going to die, but he come through. He lived over. And that's one of his main conversations now, is about being shot five times through and through with a 38, and he lived over it, you know. If you don't hit a vital place in your system some way, then I guess it's not too bad. But he's been a real hero. I guess the most talked about sheriff that this country has ever had.
While we're still in the area of politics, though, do you recall any of the any particulars about any of the more colorful governor's races?
Yeah, we I can remember quite a few of them. I can remember Moody. one in particular that created so much interest was Governor Jim Ferguson. He was the most talked about man that ever run for the governor's office, I believe. And he got, after he got the office, was he got mixed up in something, and they impeached him and got him out of the office. But he came back and run his wife for the governor, and she won. She won the race with all flying clouds. And then after she was in a term, I believe she, I don't believe she ran for the office a second time. I think her health was failing, and she didn't run. And that's when Pappy Leo Daniel came in he was another talked about governor that he had got his votes by having the, you might say, the light crust doughboys, Bob Wills and his boys, and traveling around. He had his own band, and played himself right into the mansion. He didn't have no trouble at all. But he was more or less not as much talked about as Jim Ferguson or Moss Ferguson. I think they'll always be one of our most talked about governors, unless it was one of the last two governors we've had, and that's John Connally and Preston Smith. They were made quite history in some ways. I think John Connally was a good governor, and I think Preston Smith made us a good governor, but he got mixed up in the, with the bank loan business some way, and it seemed that everybody wanted to change. And the biggest surprise of all to me was, I didn't think about it, but we'd come almost getting a Republican governor, and I didn't know he was even running a good race, but he came awfully close to winning that race. If he'd worked a little bit harder, he might have got on in there. Because, of course, our lady politician from here, Mrs. Frances Fanfold, she ran a good race, too. But this Republican governor, he really carried a lot of weight.
Do you recall any of the stories about some of the, some of the more famous Texas Rangers, such as Frank Hammond?
Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories about Frank Hammond. Incident that happens, it had a strike in Galveston. And they had some trouble in Houston too, but the Galveston was the hot place. And they said, supposedly they were sending the Texas Ranger down there to quell this thing, to put a stop to it. And some of the law down in Galveston met the train, when Ranger Hammond got off the train, they asked him where the rest of the Texas Rangers were, and he told them that there wasn't any more. And they said, "You mean that you didn't bring any Rangers with you?" And he said, "No." He said, "You just have one strike, don't you?" And he said, "All you need is one Ranger." So he did what he was supposed to do, and he stopped the thing. Don't know how many people were killed. There was a few, but not too many. But he stopped the strike. He got it under control. And he has quite a bit of history that he's made for himself. Then we have this J.Y. Baker from Hardingham. He was a real hero, and I think Baker was mostly sheriff down there and ranger, and would have W.W. Sterling, that used to be captain of the Rangers here. He was he was quite a hero, and. Well, they're the ones that I was mostly better acquainted with and had been around them a whole lot. Bill Sterling was usually come in to visit with me nearly every week. He'd be by, spend a little time with me. And he's a real fine ranger and a real fine politician, too. He was a smart man.
Do you recall any colorful stories concerning either of Mr. Baker or...
Well, Baker had nearly all of the border, and that was Bill Sterling's territory too, where they did the most of their work. And, I have a painting that Bill Sterling painted for me now that shows the cattle rustlers, horse rustlers, and desperados, you know, on the horses going back across the Rio Grande River, and shows one or two of the horses that the rider's not in the saddle. And we didn't have any more racial trouble there for several years. It kind of quieted things down. We didn't have near much trouble with, I don't think, back then. I think that everybody was more or less knew what the race was, and they kind of stayed in the category.
Do you remember any other stories about any other luncheons?
Oh, yeah. I remember several stories about they lynched a fellow in Marlin, Texas, that's in Falls County. We had a sheriff there by the name of Poole. And they lynched him, of course, back in the days, in the 19, it was long in the middle of 1910 or 12, somewhere along there. They used to have and at the county seats they used to have hangings, scaffolds built, and they did hang a few people. They didn't hang a lot of them, but they hung a man once in a while. But they mopped this jail and got this man out. He had cut his wife up and put her in a trunk and buried her. Just cut her up just in chunks. And of course they broke into the jail and they got him out and they carried him right out in the middle of the day and put him right up on the jailhouse where the hanging scaffold was and hung him in public. And then we had killing in Belton. We had a fellow by the name of Fisher who was chief of police at Temple. And we had two men run for sheriff there. And one of them name was Bigham and one of them name was Bond. One of them told a story on the other, and I told some history on him that back in the early days he had been convicted for horse stealing. And anyhow, I believe this chief of police, Wallace Fisher, is a man that brought the news out that this one had been convicted for horse stealing, and so during the race for sheriff, some prominent family, one of the members died. I think the lady of one of the larger families there, I forget the name, but Wallace Fisher drove the what they call the family cars. Used to that someone would volunteer and drive the car for the family cars for the funeral. And the funeral was in Belton, Texas, and when the funeral drove up to the church in Belton, and Wallace Felicia opened the door to get out to open the door for the family when this car went by him, and someone shot him 5 times with a 30 Remington automatic rifle. And they picked up the shells, and it was a 30 automatic that the shells was used in. And he got away. They never did catch him. And never did get any lead on who did the shooting or anything. Then after these two men had one defeated the other one for sheriff, but one night in Temple, the sheriff was walking down the street and somebody shot half of his face off with a shotgun, just really shot him bad, but didn't kill him. And he had plaster surgery, and he got patched up and got back on the job, and they had another funeral, just the same way that Wallace Fisher got wiped out. He rode, went to this funeral in Belton. He didn't ride the family funeral car or nothing, but he went to the funeral. And when he stepped out of his car at the church house, he was shot 5 times with an automatic shotgun with a Bivolov buckshot. And that's never been solved to this day. They never did find a killer for either one of them. But it was talked about a lot, and they thought they had lots of leads, but nobody ever got convicted for it or anything. They never have solved it. Killing up either side.
What was the shopping like in the early 1900s? Shopping?
Oh, the shopping was quite different from what it is today. I can remember it. And from 1909-10 and on, people would do the shopping twice a year. You didn't have automobiles. If you had an automobile, you couldn't get to town because you didn't have any good roads. You could just run it once in a while, and that wasn't too much. There wasn't any good roads, and ruts would be cut deep, and you just didn't make the. You didn't go to town too much in your automobile, and there you would go to town, like just when the school was going to open. They'd go to town in wagons and buggies or surreys, and they'd buy all they wanted clothes and school clothes. They'd make one trip and they'd buy everything. And then they would go to town, next it would be when spring would come on. They'd go to town by the summer clothes. And that was about the only two times that you'd ever hear anything mentioned about going shopping. And you didn't have to go to the big towns because they had, usually in one of the little towns, they'd have a big mercantile business owned by two or three people. And they carried everything from all the patent medicine to the druggist, all the groceries, clothing, implements, anything you wanted, you could buy it in one place. You didn't have to go to different places. Part of the early automobiles business was down at these mercantile places, and you could buy your automobile there. They'd keep one or two inside the store, and there people walk around it, you know, look at it. And I can remember the first Ford that I ever saw in Falls County was owned by a man by the name Aldine Hood. I never will forget it. The radiator was brass, all the finish on it was brass. And the cars were built the same width as the wagons, because of the mud roads that the ruts would cut out. If your car wasn't wide, you didn't go anywhere. You couldn't travel. And they had,
what they called the
Maxwell automobile, and they had the Star, and they had the Durant, they had the Oakland, and the Ford. But along in 1915 and 16, they began to bring in more Fords and Chevrolets. And then along in 17 and 18, they began to put starters on them where you wouldn't have to get out and crank them if you killed it in a mud hole or something. But I drove a car for our neighbor, his name was Richard Drummond. I never will forget it. It was a Buick. And it was a right-hand drive, and the motor sat underneath of the body, just a little motor, and it cranked from the side. The engine sat around the side. And my daddy owned a Studebaker in 1910. I was just big enough to get it started, and I drove it out in the field, stuck it in flat dirt, and stripped the rain gear in it, and actually got a whipping, but I managed to talk out of it. But he got that fixed. Fella came out from Marling, put a new rain gear in it, he got it fixed up, and then he prayed it for a baby, not a baby, but he prayed it for an Oakland automobile. And it was a real fine car. We drove it until about 1922. But it was real fine, real pretty car back in those days. But in 1921, I bought me a Ford. I bought a used automobile. In 1924, I bought my first new Ford, and it cost me $437. I remember the exact penny I paid for it in 1924. I don't know if you had one today, it would bring you three times that much, even that model, if it was run. Maybe more. But that's what I paid for my Ford in 1924. The first new car I ever bought, I paid $437 for it. Bought it from Duncan in Waco, Texas. Then we had a dry year in 1925, and I drove it out to West Texas and picked cotton. That's what I paid for it. What I promised I would own it, and I picked that and paid for that car. I was in some parts of Tom Green County, out around Ballinger and Miles, that had just a little strip of country in there that made pretty good cotton, and I went out there and picked cotton. And I went to town one afternoon in the Ford, and come up a hailstorm and liked to beat it all to pieces. And I never will forget it. On the way back out to the farm where I was picking cotton, you could see jackrabbits, even to once in a while a young calf, something that Haley beat to death. It was an awful hailstorm. Brother and I, next to my oldest fellow and I, went to town on Saturday evening to come that hail, and I tell you, I never will forget it. I was scared to death. The hail was as big as teacups.
Did any fairs ever come to the town where you lived by? Any fairs? Country fairs?
Yeah.
You remember being at early country fairs?
Oh, yeah, not right where I was raised. Now, they used to have a fair in McLennan County, Waco, Texas, called the Cotton Palace. I guess it's mostly more so like what they've had in Dallas for the last 2-3 years, but this Cotton Palace was a big thing. It'd come every year, paid for about stayed for probably 6-7 weeks. You could see everything that is magical at this Cotton Palace. And they had all kinds of animals, wild animals, and anything that you'd ever heard about, you could see it at this Cotton Palace. And we used to have to go, they'd take us, we'd have to go 3-4 times so before we could get to see everything. And we were always anxious for the Cotton Palace to get started, because that was a big thing back in those days. I think you could see more at the Cotton Palace than you could see at the Barn Bailey Ring Brothers show. I mean, it was bigger. It was a big thing. I saw a python at the Cotton Palace. I'll never forget, 1921. The city was 37 feet long, weighed over 300 pounds. His bucket, they'd take a 10 quart bucket and his head wouldn't even go in the bucket. He was a monster. Just coiled up in the pen. And they fed him 250 pound hogs at a meal. That's what they'd feed him. The man that he told me that they would feed this 250 pound hog at a meal when they fed him. And he said that snakes would swallow an animal like that, and after a certain length of time, they'd vomit the bones up. They didn't digest the bones, they only digest the meat, and they'd vomit the bones up of an animal when they swallowed it. I don't know, I just wondered if that could be true, but I guess more likely it has to be, because that's the only way we'd have getting rid of it.
Do you remember any old home remedies for ailments?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had a lot of home remedies for ailments. Something, if someone stick a nail in the foot, you'd run to get your pan of cola on, put your foot in a pan of cola and let it soak for an hour or two, and then you could never did bother you, heal right up. All the young kids, from babies up to 10 or 15 years old, would have what they call croup. And they had once, sometimes they'd choke to death with it. They'd get where they couldn't cough it up, so they'd just croup all night. And their mothers would take them, take coal, turpentine, and a little lard, and smear it all on a piece of flannel cloth, and put it on your chest, tie a little sock around your neck. It's a stocking that you'd worn, and next morning you'd get up feeling pretty good. And it always seemed to work. If that didn't work, they'd give you castor oil. And most of them rather have the flannel than take the castor oil. Boy, when you mentioned castor oil back then, all the kids knew what it was. They didn't like castor oil, but they didn't mind the flannel with turpentine and coal oil and a little lard. And it's rub the chest and put this flannel cloth over it and cover them up. And they'd get over it. But they would get pretty bad with it. Sometimes they'd scare hell out of you. You'd think they're going to choke to death, but they'd come out of it. But they really had a siege of it right then, more so than they do now. Because they didn't have any vitamins or anything like that to avoid these colds off. When you had a cold, you just had to wear them out or do something there. You didn't have the preventative like they have now.
you think of anything else you'd like to mention?
Anything that you might have in mind?
No, there might be something you want to include on here.
Times have changed, and there's quite a difference to times now and times then. When I can remember when I would go to town and I'd buy one thing specifically I remember very well. I'd buy 2 boxes of 22 shorts, and they were made by Remington, and they would call less smoke. I get 2 boxes for a quarter, and I'd take them home. And of course, we had a lot of squirrels and rabbits where I was raised, and we'd get go on the hunt with a 22 rifle. They'd give us a half a dozen shells, and that's all we had. And then we'd have to bring something back that we didn't get to go hunting anymore. It didn't give you a box of shells and everything like that. And people would buy shotgun shells. You could buy them in broken boxes, 5 or 6 shells. And a lot of places just kept a big basket up on the counter at the showcase in the stores and it's hardwired. And you go and buy 6 shotgun shells and you'd make a hunting trip on it. And now you buy 6 boxes and make a hunting trip. But there's quite a bit of difference in it. The way we had the ammunition to kill our game and the way we have it today. And we were very careful that we didn't waste any of it. Every time we fired a shell, we'd try to get something to eat with it, make a hit with it, but we enjoy it, I believe, more so than we do today. Actually, I look forward to going hunting more on a squirrel hunt than I would go deer hunting today. I had more fun. We'd take a rifle and go squirrel hunting and kill 8-10 squirrels and skin them and buy them real fine. You fry them up and make cream gravy and hot biscuits. Good eating.
Thank you, Mr. Conley.
And he told me that he'd seen this happen so many times that he could paint that, you know, and pretty well as he had seen it by the time. And I understand that this fellow Baker was quite a hero in along the border. And I don't think that any 2 Texas Ranger ever made any more history on in the valley than Bill Sterling and Baker did. We had a Texas Ranger that made a lot of history by the name of Gonzalez, but he was further up the river, up in the Laredo country on up the Eagle Pass. Then we have a Texas Ranger that from Carriza Spring, and he has a lot of history for himself, and his son is from Texas Ranger now. He had a lot of history when during this farm labor trouble that they had in the valley in the last 2-3 years right down in Sapati County, down in the border town. And it was Ranger Atlee. His home is in Caesar Springs. He's a one of our most read about, talked about Texas Rangers, I guess, that we have today. There's more history and more, it's more said about him than anyone else that's ever been in the Rangers Department.
Earlier you told a story about a Negro that was involved in a rape case in Temple. Could you retell that story, please?
There was a young Negro broke in the house of some lady in Temple back in the early 20s. And beat her up, raped her. And the law caught him and they rushed him off to jail and put him in jail. And someone organized a group of men that night they put him in jail. And they all got together and they went down to jail and they couldn't get him out. They wouldn't. They kept him locked. The jailer wouldn't come out to talk to him. And they got a big highline post that they were putting in some new highlines through there. And they all, about 14 or 15 men, got this post up in their arms, and they made a run, rush on the jailhouse door with the butt end of that pole, and they caved the door, and they caved the building, just knocked the door plumb in. They went in and overpowered the jailer, got the Negro, and they drug him behind the automobiles and burned him, and even tied and drug him around down the streets after they burned him, after his body had been burned.